And because ambiguity, there's a lot of ambiguity about ambiguity. Is this statute really ambiguous? And different courts had different approaches to that. Some judges, I was one of them on the D.C. Circuit, was pretty tight on that, but a lot of judges would be could find ambiguity in the statute. And the executive branch would try to say, look, court, this statute's ambiguous, and therefore defer to us in upholding the rule that we've enacted pursuant to the regulation, pursuant to the statute. It might be an environmental regulation. It might be an energy regulation, a healthcare regulation. And this was a bipartisan phenomenon. This has nothing to do with partisanship. Administrations of all stripes would try to, in essence, stretch statutory authorizations. Now, why would this happen? And I'll just give a brief background of how this would come up. When you're running for president, you run on, I'm going to improve the healthcare system, I'm going to improve the immigration system, I'm going to improve the environment, I'm going to improve energy production, I'm going to reform, you name the issue, the labor management relations, whatever it might be. You run on policy, and often you're running on changing policy, improving policy from what it has been. And then you get into office, and it's hard to pass new legislation. By design in our constitutional system, it's hard to pass new legislation. And what inevitably happens, again, a completely bipartisan phenomenon, is that there's pressure put on the agencies to try to achieve through the regulatory process what cannot be achieved through the legislative process. And Chevron really facilitated this effort to, some would say, circumvent the constitutional process of legislation by giving authority to the executive to establish and issue really big, important regulations that would have huge effects on the American people without having gone through bicameralism and presentment in the Congress and signed by the president. So what we did in Loper Bright, the Chief Justice's opinion, was, I think, a course correction consistent with the separation of powers to make sure that the executive branch is acting within the authorization granted to it by Congress. Now, to be clear, don't overread Loper Bright. Oftentimes, Congress will grant a broad authorization to an executive agency, so it's really important as a neutral umpire to respect the line that Congress has drawn, and when it's granted broad authorization, not to unduly hinder the executive branch from performing its congressionally authorized functions, but at the same time not allowing the executive branch, as it could with Chevron in its toolkit, to go beyond the congressional authorization. I think Chevron, and the Chief Justice's opinion reflects this, distorted the separation of powers and in ways that were problematic and circumvented the legislative process that the Constitution prescribes in ways that were constitutionally problematic. So I see it as a course correction.
You mentioned in the course of your answer, if you're running for president, and of course, you served in a very senior role in the George W. Bush administration before you were appointed to the D.C. Circuit. So you got to see the institution of the presidency up close in a way that a lot of judges have not had the opportunity to do. Do you think that that experience has influenced the way you see separation of powers cases and maybe even Loper Bright specifically?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's had a huge influence on me in all sorts of ways. I've worked in the White House for 5.5 years for President Bush from 2001 to 2006, 2 years in the counsel's office, and then 3 years a job called staff secretary, where I traveled with him all over the country, and all, including in the 2004 reelect. So various, at least the states, certain states in the country at that point, and then all over the world as well, including, just as an aside, probably if you asked me, my number one memory from that whole 5.5 year experience was we traveled to the Vatican in 2004, and the President Bush was awarding Pope John Paul II the Presidential Medal of Freedom at the Vatican. And I was fortunate enough to be on that trip and to be in the room when President Bush awarded Pope John Paul II the Medal of Freedom. And as a Catholic kid, to be with the American president and the Pope in the Vatican It's going to be tough to top that. And it was very powerful, the statement the president made about the son of Poland who became the Bishop of Rome and a hero for the ages. And it was very powerful. And then the Pope, who was not doing great health-wise at that point, took the medal, which was in a nice presidential box, and kind of held it up a little bit and said, God bless America. And it was just a great moment. So that's not separation of powers, but that's a good, you know, it's a good memory. So on back to the separation of powers, let's try to stay on topic here. The President Bush was like every other president I mentioned, bipartisan phenomenon. He had a lot of things he wanted to get done as president. Of course, September 11th altered the course of his presidency, but he still had, in the domestic arena, a lot of things he wanted to get done with respect to the environment, energy, immigration, and what have you. And he, like all modern presidents, would be frustrated by the legislative process. Very difficult to get things through the legislative process. And I saw this up close. On the legislative process, if you think about the Constitution, it takes the House, takes the Senate, takes the President, and in the Senate, under current rules, takes 60 votes for most legislation. The legislative process in our Constitution is designed to be incremental, to be consensus. It takes consensus to get legislation, and that means things are going to be incremental. It's hard to get big legislation through, at least without a crisis of some sort post-September 11th, the financial crisis in 2008, things like that. But otherwise, it's very hard to get major legislation. So I saw in his administration, just like I've seen in other administrations, pressure on the agencies to push the envelope. And how Chevron facilitated that was sometimes agency lawyers or other officials might think, you know, this is not really the best reading of the statute. But we really want to get this policy objective achieved. And with Chevron, you never know. Maybe the court will uphold it. Maybe we can convince there's an ambiguity here, there's something there, there's a gap there, let's go for it. So even if the agency thought, yeah, it's not the best reading of the statute, there would be pressure to go forward, and you would go for it. And then you get to court. So this, I see this later from my D.C. Circuit perspective. You get into court, and the judges might think, you know, this is not the best reading of the statute. What the executive's doing here is beyond the scope of the statute, best read under the usual tools of statutory interpretation. But there's an ambiguity. And therefore, just even though we don't think it's the best, we're going to uphold it under Chevron. And what you could have then is really massive new regulations, or important new, they don't have to be massive, just important or new regulations that were issued and approved even though no one thought it was actually consistent with the best reading of the statute that had been passed by Congress and signed by the president. So that's how it happened. That's the pressure that created it in the executive branch. That's how the phenomenon evidenced itself in the judicial branch. And that, I think, if I've described it correctly, shows how the separation of powers process prescribed by the Constitution could be distorted.
Just one last question on Chevron and Loper-Bright. This, your joining of the majority opinion in Loper-Bright wasn't your first kind of foray into this. You'd been a critic of Chevron for many years. You had this 2016 Harvard Law Review article where you criticized Chevron and some other canons of interpretation insofar as they required threshold determinations that were not susceptible to principled adjudication. So you said earlier, jokingly, you know, there's ambiguity about ambiguity. That was one of your criticisms of Chevron then.
Yeah.
So it seems to me like there's a theme here to your jurisprudence that you have a preference for rules over standards, that you have kind of a formalist instinct of seeking to cabin judicial discretion. Do you think that's a fair characterization? You cite Justice Scalia's rule of law as a law of rules in that 2016 Harvard Law Review piece?
I do think it's fair to say, as a judge, I prefer rules over standards. And just to go back a second to the ambiguity about ambiguity and explain to the students and others how that would come about as a judge on the D.C. Circuit. Hearing one of those big cases, this could be a massive regulation, billions of dollars at stake, challenged as being outside the statutory authorization. You get into the conference room after the oral argument with two other judges, panels of three in the Court of Appeals. And the three judges might agree that the statute was not the best, the regulation was not the best reading of the statute. What the executive was trying to do was unlawful. But then you'd get into a argument about, but is it ambiguous? And therefore, we should uphold the regulation nonetheless. And you could have, and this happened in my experience, two judges say, you know, I think it's ambiguous enough, so I'm going to vote to uphold it. And one judge, often me, would say, I don't think that's the way to go about it here under our separation of powers and under the Administrative Procedure Act, and I don't think that's the best reading of the statute, and I think, therefore, and so the whole thing, billions of dollars, important safety regulations, whatever it might be, would turn not on a debate about the best reading of the statute, you might all agree on that, but on a debate about whether it's ambiguous enough to uphold. And that struck me as a really bizarre set of circumstances, which I described in that law review piece that you mentioned. More generally, why rules over standards? Sometimes, of course, you're going to have standards in the law as a matter of precedent, as a matter of the text you're interpreting, unreasonable searches and seizures. There's all sorts of. But if you can, as Justice Scalia said, oftentimes, rules are preferable because rules constrain discretion. And why is it important for rules to constrain judicial discretion? I think it goes to that idea of the judge as umpire. Judges are supposed to be neutral and to make the same call regardless of whether, and apply the same principles regardless of whether it favors Republican or Democrat, environmental interest or developer, business or labor, whatever it might be, we have to be consistent in applying the same principles to everyone without regard to policy or politics or partisanship. And rules constrain discretion more than open-ended standards. And with open-ended standards, Justice Scalia would often say, the suspicion would be, and sometimes the temptation, and sometimes the reality, would be that policy or other considerations would infuse the decision, and therefore you wouldn't have this kind of neutral judicial resolution. So apply a rule, develop a rule rather than an open-ended multi-factor balancing test. I think that's preferable as a general proposition, knowing that these are all gray areas and nothing's going to be that way all the time.
Right. Well, your concern with cabining judicial discretion was also at the heart of your concurrence in United States versus Rahimi this past term, a case about the right to keep and bear arms. So let me just set this up a little bit. In that concurrence, you argued that when it comes to discerning the scope of constitutional rights where you don't have on-point precedent, you said, quote, there are really only two potential ways to do this, right? You said history or policy. Now, you contended that it's more consistent with the judicial role to rely on history rather than policy. It's less subjective, right? Mm-hmm. But I want to zero in on one particular use of history, which was part of your analysis in that concurrence. And that's history that long postdates the moment of ratification of a constitutional provision, what we might call tradition. And here in your concurrence, you seem to defend the use of tradition as a way of interpreting the scope of constitutional rights. And there, it seems like you're at least roughly on the same page, if I may say so, with my colleague, Professor Mark DeGirolami, who's a great defender of tradition.
Good work.
but it also appears that you have at least a mild disagreement on that front with many originalists, including Sharif Girgis at Notre Dame, who has criticized the court's use of tradition in this way, because it doesn't seem to, this history long post-dating ratification doesn't seem to have any bearing on what the text meant when it was ratified, which is why originalists look at history at that moment of ratification. So do you agree that originalism doesn't really justify this use of tradition? And if so, then what is the justification for that reliance on tradition?
I'm going to answer in the alternative.
Okay.
Is that okay? First, I will say that there is a great tradition in the judiciary of relying on tradition. And that's going to sound circular, but I'm going to explain it. So Justice Scalia and Judge Bork, Chief Justice Rehnquist, are really the modern Mount Rushmore of originalism, in my view. And going back to John Marshall and James Madison, Federalist 37, McCulloch versus Maryland, those people all relied on historical practice, even historical practice that was more recent from the time of ratification, so long as it had been a consistent historical practice over time, as a way to interpret constitutional text where, and this is an important premise, you mentioned it, but just to underscore for the students, where the text itself doesn't answer the question,